Short Rounds.
Welcome back to the Unknown Soldiers Podcast. I am your host, James Hauser. So today for you guys, I have a short round, and it's called Mill Springs 1862, the Union's First Victory in the West, also known as I Don't Have a Clever Title. Today's episode is about a Civil War battle, the Battle of Mill Springs, Kentucky, January 19th, 1862. This battle isn't super famous, it was pretty small scale, but it was a small battle with a big impact. Today's story is all about how Kentucky, at the outbreak of the Civil War, one of America's most strategically vital states, could have joined either North or South, and why it ended up staying in the Union throughout the Civil War. This involves some diplomacy, some politics, some very bad hiring decisions, and a major battle, the Battle of Mill Springs, that was decisive for securing Kentucky for the Union. I have two big reasons for doing this short round. First, the Civil War was my first love as a very young history nerd, and I look for any excuse to talk about it, and I'll talk about it a long time, which is also why this short round is not so short. Second reason, I'm doing a favor for my good friend Liam Rook, who is writing an alternate history series about the Civil War. The events I describe today go very differently in his alternate universe, because what happens if Kentucky sides with the South and not the North? That's an interesting question to ponder. Today I'm telling you what actually happened, but if you want to read his book, you can find out what might have happened. So let's head back to the early days of the Civil War, the battle for the border states, and meet up on a cold, rainy winter's morning in eastern Kentucky. As always, this is not just history, but military history. There's a lot of dark and bloody stuff going on. Podcast is PG-13, language is clean, content is not. All my sources and a couple of maps are on my website, unknownsoldierspodcast.com, link in the description. Finally, any errors, mispronunciations, or mistakes are my responsibility. I'm going to entertain you, but all the information is accurate to the best of my knowledge. This was a real story with real people who don't deserve to be unknown soldiers. All right, it is 1861. The American Civil War has just begun. On July 21st, 1861, the Union and Confederate armies fought the first big battle of the war, the Battle of First Bull Run, or First Manassas, just outside of Washington, D.C. Union lost, Confederacy won, but that didn't settle the issue. And Bull Run was the only major battle of 1861. Both sides spent the rest of the year gathering resources, training troops, and preparing for a longer conflict. The post-Bull Run period, like late 1861, early 1862, this weird waiting period after Bull Run before the rest of the big battles, was a weird phase in the Civil War. Not many battles, not many, but a whole lot of politics, organization, diplomacy, mostly revolving around the border regions. Those areas between the Union and Confederacy who hadn't chosen a side yet, who could still swing one way or the other. First off, there were four slave states that had not joined the Confederacy. These are states where slavery is legal, but they are still in the Union. They are Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri. All and most of these states had pro-Union and pro-Confederacy factions within the state that were still struggling for power after the Civil War started. Well, not really Delaware. Delaware didn't really count much. And there were also pro-Union factions in states that had seceded, like Tennessee and Virginia, where East Tennessee and West Virginia were extremely pro-Union sections of Confederate states. And there were contested territories out west, Indian Territory, aka Oklahoma, and New Mexico Territory. And I covered those in copious detail in episodes 32 and 36. So if you haven't heard those and you want to hear more about what was going on in the weird in-between places of the Civil War, episodes 32 and 36, I talk about that a lot. Anyway, so all these areas were on the fence. They could split either north or south with a potentially huge impact on the Civil War. The two really big prizes were Kentucky and Missouri. Two big, high population, large economy states, but they were also slave states. Two states that held vital strategic positions on the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. Two states with large important urban centers at St. Louis and Louisville. Two states with large plantation classes, but equally large pro-Union factions, including the large urban centers. Two states with pro-Confederate governors, and pro-union legislatures. Like, the governor wants to side with the South, the state legislature, the state Congress wants to side with the North. That's going to be a problem. That had already caused chaos in Missouri. In June 1861, pro-Union and pro-Confederate militias had already started fighting. There was a major battle at Wilson's Creek. Missouri was overrun with raids and guerrillas. And just absolute buku out-the-butt violence in Missouri. Missouri is being torn apart but as its pro-Union and pro-Confederate factions, and then the Union and Confederacy both filter troops into the state to support their side, and it becomes a mess. Missouri suffered enormously throughout the Civil War as a result of this infighting within the state. But today we're really talking about Kentucky. Kentucky's leaders were famous in the lead-up to the Civil War for always trying to mediate, to compromise, to ride the fence between North and South. They were always being like, hey guys, can't we just get along? The great Kentucky politician, Henry Clay, formulated the Compromise of 1850, which, you know, was a compromise between the slave and free states, which probably staved off the Civil War for about 10 years. And just before Fort Sumter was fired on, Kentucky Senator John J. Crittenden tried to broker a compromise between Lincoln's government and the newly formed Confederacy. So Kentucky's politicians are always trying to ride the fence between North and South, trying to play both sides. But you can only play both sides for so long. Eventually there's going to be a civil war, right? In 1861, Kentucky's governor, Beriah McGoffin, was pro-Southern. But the legislature was massively pro-Union by like a three-quarters margin. John Crittenden and the moderates worried that Kentucky might descend into chaos just like Missouri. They're looking over at what's going on in Missouri. They're going, that looks like it sucks, guys. So they propose Kentucky remain neutral. Like, what if we just don't want to be in the Civil War? What if we just don't pick a side? So in May 1861, just after the Civil War began, the Kentucky legislature passed a bill that declared, "This state and the citizens thereof should take no part in the civil war now being waged, except as mediators and friends to the belligerent parties, and that Kentucky should, during the contest, occupy the position of strict neutrality." That's cute. Good luck with that. Soon, pro-Union and pro-Confederate Kentuckians were forming militias all over the state. Union troops concentrated on the northern border across the Ohio River, right in Indiana and Ohio, right across from Louisville. And Confederate troops camped across the border in Tennessee, like these two storm clouds of armies gathering on either side of Kentucky. This was the situation from May until September 1861. The North and the South don't move troops into Kentucky. But Kentucky's like just like this white space on the map. Everybody's like moving around it. But the Kentucky state government's like, ha ha ha, this is fine, this is fine, this is fine. This was extremely naive. Like, dude, you're between North and South. The rivers flow through you. The railroads pass through you. Armies are forming up on your borders. Thousands of Kentuckians are taking up arms for either side. This is not sustainable. Eventually, Kentucky's neutrality was going to fall apart. But how it fell apart was important. How it fell apart. United States President Abraham Lincoln and Confederate President Jefferson Davis each really wanted Kentucky on their side, and one wrong step, one screw-up, could push Kentucky into the other side. Like, you make them mad enough, they'll just go join the other guys. So even though Kentucky was super important strategically, neither side sent any troops, made any demands on Kentucky for months. Lincoln and Davis both talked to politicians and sent letters and tried to persuade Kentucky to join them as the Civil War went on around it. Like, there's battles going on in states to either side of Kentucky this whole time. Eventually, something's going to snap. It almost snapped in August 1861. The Union commander in Missouri was Major General John C. Fremont, a famous explorer, politician, and radical abolitionist. On August 30th, 1861, without running it by the Lincoln administration, he issued a proclamation emancipating all the slaves of Confederate supporters or sympathizers. Okay, yes, freeing the slaves is good, we can all agree, but Fremont's political timing was abysmal. At this point, most Northerners saw the war as a crusade to preserve the Union. They were The North was very ambivalent on the issue of slavery at this point in the war. They might not support the war if the cause was to free the slaves, especially not in the border states, like Kentucky, which was still a slave state. Any talk of abolitionism might spook the border regions into the Confederacy's arms. And Kentucky was almost spooked. When Fremont's proclamation came out, public opinion swung towards the South. One of the Kentucky Unionist leaders wrote to Abraham Lincoln. He said,
"There is not a day to lose in disavowing emancipation, or Kentucky is gone over."
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln was an abolitionist, but he kept that quiet because he knew most Northerners weren't yet. Abolitionism was still seen as radical. The North had to be slow-walked into supporting the freedom of the slaves. Lincoln wanted to free the slaves, but if Fremont scared Kentucky into joining the Confederacy, the South might win the Civil War, and then no slaves would be freed. Winning the war had to be first priority. As Lincoln said in September 1861, when the crisis was at its peak,
"I think to lose Kentucky is nearly the same as to lose the whole game."
Lincoln ordered Fremont to rescind the decree. Fremont refused, so Lincoln himself publicly rescinded the decree and then fired Fremont a few weeks later. This made him very unpopular with the abolitionists in late 1861, so he's catching fire from both sides now. And Fremont's mishaps still came close to driving Kentucky into seceding from the Union. Like, the Kentuckians are all upset about this thing, but it didn't. Because only a few weeks after Fremont's blunder, the Confederates did something worse. Something you'll hear people say about the Civil War is that the Confederacy had the best generals. And when people say this, they're usually talking about Robert E. Lee, who led the main Confederate army in Virginia, the Eastern Theater. But Virginia wasn't the whole war, and the truth is, each side had a couple of great generals, a few decent generals, and a whole bunch of knuckleheads. The Western Theater, Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, was where the Confederacy kept their knuckleheads. Most of the Confederate generals in the West, man, it's a race to the freaking bottom. These guys just suck. Braxton Bragg, John Bell Hood, John C. Pemberton, Gideon J. Pillow. There's a decent argument the South lost the Civil War because of the doofus crew running the Western Theater. Confederate President Jefferson Davis kept putting the doofuses in charge. Davis was a horrible judge of military ability. He kept putting the same gang of idiots in charge of things, even when they sucked, because they were his friends. Or he thought they were cool, or he liked them. And today, we will meet 1, 2, 3 Davis-appointed Confederate doofuses who lost Kentucky for the South. Doofus number one was Leonidas Polk. Born in 1806, Leonidas Polk came from a wealthy and influential Southern family. His cousin was President James K. Polk. Leonidas Polk attended the United States Military Academy at West Point, but while he was there, he caught a dose of religion, so he resigned his commission as soon as he graduated and became an Episcopalian clergyman. By the time the Civil War broke out in 1861, he was the Bishop of Louisiana. So Leonidas Polk had not spent one day of his life on real military service. He was barely qualified to be a second lieutenant. But Jefferson Davis made Leonidas Polk a major general. Why? Because Davis and Polk had been West Point classmates, and he thought Polk was just a swell dude. Polk was tall, handsome, and charismatic. He was much beloved by many people in the South as the Fighting Bishop, as he was called. Unfortunately for the South, Polk was a moron. Worse, Polk was a moron who thought he was smart. He was also a backstabbing schemer, stubborn and petty and childish, and incompetent. But Jeff Davis liked him. So Leonidas Polk became one of the Confederacy's top-ranking generals in the Western Theater, just generally hamstringing the Confederate cause throughout the war. There are like 3 battles the South loses where Polk is at least partially or not mostly responsible. Stones River and Chickamauga are the big two. You can count Perryville if you really want to. Long story. So Polk just messes things up for the South and the Western Theater until he gets bisected by an artillery shell in 1864. And just like his fellow doofuses, General Bragg and General Hood, Polk used to have a U.S. Army fort named after him until very recently, which makes a weird kind of sense because Confederate generals like Bragg, Polk, and Hood did a lot to help the Union win the Civil War. Jeff Davis put Leonidas Polk in charge of Confederate forces in western Tennessee along the Mississippi River. His mission was to defend the river from Union invasion, but Polk had trouble finding good defensive positions for his artillery. Okay, there was one really good position, a town on a high bluff overlooking the Mississippi River where his artillery could easily defeat any Union gunboats. The problem was that that town was Columbus, Kentucky, just across the Tennessee border inside a neutral state. But it was also the best defensive position on the Mississippi River. So Polk figured, I'm sure they won't mind. Plus, if I don't occupy it, the Union will. So on September 4th, 1861, without asking or even telling Jefferson Davis, Polk's troops steamed north to occupy Columbus, Kentucky without a fight. Easy peasy. Well done, boys. Polk's seizure of Columbus is a great example of something that makes good military sense, but horrible political sense. Like, oh good, tactically that's a great defensive position. Politically, it was a blatant violation of Kentucky neutrality, an unprovoked violation of states' rights, the thing the South said they were fighting for. Only 6 days earlier, the Kentuckians had been all upset about Fremont's Emancipation Decree. They forgot all about that. Public opinion swung immediately and completely against the South. On September 7, 1861, the Kentucky General Assembly ordered all Confederate forces to withdraw from Kentucky territory. This was Jeff Davis's chance to tell Polk he was a knucklehead, order him to evacuate, and maybe salvage the situation. But Davis hesitated, failed to make a decision, and he didn't want to be mean to his friend. So he just said, well, too late now. A few days later, Kentucky legislature declared neutrality over. They had sided with the Union. Polk's invasion and Davis's refusal to disavow or countermand it had been the tipping point. Polk's seizure of Columbus, Kentucky, this little thing that where no one died, was one of the decisive moments of the Civil War. It was a political and military disaster for the Confederacy. If Kentucky had seceded, it would have become the second most populous state in the Confederacy, with huge economic and manpower resources. It was one of the most fertile states in America, in a strategic position that dominated the Mississippi River watershed. The South's chances of winning the Civil War would have increased dramatically. Kentuckians did fight on both sides of the Civil War, but much more for the Union. The Union recruited 60 infantry regiments from Kentucky. The Confederacy only recruited 9. Around 125,000 Kentuckians fought for the Union versus only 25,000 Confederate. How many of those Kentuckians would have signed up for the South if it had been the Union to violate Kentucky's neutrality? Who knows? But that's, a bunch of troops the South could have freaking used. So Kentucky was no longer neutral, and the Union and Confederacy both began to move troops into the state. Union armies began to gather at Louisville under General Don Carlos Buell, and at Paducah near Columbus under General Ulysses S. Grant. The Confederacy's new commander in the West, General Albert Sidney Johnston, set up a defensive line across southern Kentucky. This line extended 300 miles from the Mississippi River to the Appalachian Mountains, covering all the major invasion routes. There was Polk's 15,000 men at Columbus, blocking the Mississippi River, Simon B. Buckner's 10,000 men blocking the Louisville-Nashville Railroad at Bowling Green, and then there was a third army, a small army about 5,000 to 6,000 men strong, occupying the critical Cumberland Gap over in the Appalachians. And it is this army and our other two doofuses that would fight the Battle of Mill Springs. Ooh, okay. We are finally going to get into the lead up to this battle. It only took me how long? Okay, let's get moving. Okay. Something folks don't grasp about the Civil War is how much pro-Union sentiment there was in parts of the Confederacy. Tennessee was the last state to secede from the Union in June 1861, and the vote to secede was very narrow. West Tennessee, plantation country, was pro-Southern. But East Tennessee, the mountainous Appalachian region around Chattanooga and Knoxville and Johnson City, was very pro-Union. Like, yeah, this is like, you know, this is redneck country these days, sure. But back in the day, more than 80% of East Tennesseans voted against seceding from the Union. And when that failed, they tried to form their own state of East Tennessee, just like West Virginia. They're like, oh, you secede from the Union? We'll secede from you. The Confederates like, no, only we can secede from people. The Confederacy had to place East Tennessee under martial law in 1861. They had to send troops to put down Unionist uprisings and guerrilla bands all over the mountains. The South is fighting a freaking counterinsurgency campaign in one of its own states. That doesn't get talked about much. That's actually a really good subject for an episode at some point. Internal Confederate resistance to the Civil War. Anyway, that's a thought, writing that down. The situation in East Tennessee led to the appointment of Doofus Number 2. Felix K. Zollicoffer has the distinction of being dead last in any list of Civil War generals. Who else has the name Zollicoffer? And he never should have been a general in the first place. Zollicoffer was one of Tennessee's leading citizens, a former congressman and the editor of a newspaper, the Nashville Banner. Basically the 19th century equivalent of, like, a blogger. Or, like, one of those politicians who's always on Fox News or CNN. This dude would have a very high follower account on Twitter if it was around in 1861, and all his opinions would be terrible. And when the Civil War broke out, Zollicoffer really wanted to be a general. America has a long, proud tradition of anti-intellectualism, where anyone can become an expert on anything with 5 minutes of Googling. Well, this was kind of true during the Civil War, too. Your small business owner or county politician or newspaper man would flip through an obsolete tactical manual for a minute and say, well, I'm basically qualified to be a general now. I am only slightly exaggerating. The Civil War is full of guys called general with no business being generals. Felix K. Zollicoffer had fought very briefly in the Tennessee militia during an Indian war, during which he basically did nothing. This is a guy with less military experience than Leonidas Polk. So, of course, Jefferson Davis made Felix K. Zollicoffer a brigadier general, mainly because of his political influence, partially because he just thought this guy was cool. Davis hoped that Zollicoffer's popularity and political ability would make him useful in putting down the uprisings in East Tennessee. This appointment was explicitly for political reasons. Zollicoffer was hired explicitly to calm things down in East Tennessee. He was not supposed to be in command in the field. And Zollicoffer's biggest handicap as a general wasn't even his lack of military experience. Lots of guys didn't have much of that in the Civil War, and they did kind of okay. It was that he was very, very, very nearsighted. Zollicoffer wasn't technically blind, but only technically, like he absolutely could not get a driver's license. And as a general in the Civil War, being able to see at least sort of a long distance was extremely important. You have to be able to survey the ground, pick out obstacles and good terrain and avenues of approach, see what your units are doing and what the enemies are doing. What's that unit over there a mile away? Is that our unit or their unit? You have to be able to find that out, like by looking at them. But Davis figured, he'll probably be at a desk. What harm can he do? Brigadier General he is. So Davis put Zollicoffer in charge of Confederate forces in East Tennessee. Zollicoffer set up his headquarters in Knoxville and started taking care of the uprisings. So far, so good. Then in September 1861, Leonidas Polk occupied Columbus, and Kentucky's neutrality was over. As soon as he learned of Polk's move, Zollicoffer marched his troops into Kentucky to occupy Cumberland Gap. Cumberland Gap sits at the far western tip of Virginia on the border between Kentucky and Tennessee. It's one of the main passages through the Appalachian Mountains, legendary in American frontier history, like a lot of the pioneers passed through Cumberland Gap. You'll hear that, you hear it in songs a lot. It's in like Wagon Wheel, there's a song called Cumberland Gap. It's a very obvious place on the map. But Zollicoffer's occupation of Cumberland Gap placed him in the path of Union strategic thinking. Abraham Lincoln really wanted to get some troops into East Tennessee to help out the Tennessee Unionists, and any troops moving from Kentucky towards East Tennessee would have to pass through the Cumberland Gap. So Lincoln ordered Union troops to drive the Confederates out of eastern Kentucky and clear the way into East Tennessee. So now Zollicoffer was on a collision course with Union forces marching southeast from Louisville and Lexington, Kentucky. Felix Zollicoffer was way out of his depth commanding an army all alone in eastern Kentucky. The zero books he'd ever read on warfare hadn't prepared him for this. He wrote,
"The responsibility is great. I feel my want of experience and knowledge of war for so large a command."
Hey, buddy, you wanted to be a general. Zollicoffer had been ordered to hold Cumberland Gap and defend it, but he decided that this was stupid. So he abandoned his defensive mission. He left like one unit in Cumberland Gap, like, hey guys, be careful. And then he began to march into eastern Kentucky with the rest of his army, looking for a confrontation with the Union forces. He said,
"We march into Kentucky for the purpose of defending the people of a sister southern state against an invading northern army and their federal adherents."
Dude, Felix, to Kentuckians, you're the invader. They made that very clear. You do get that, right? President Jefferson Davis, who was dealing with like 20 other things at any given time, had a thought one day. He's like, oh, hey, Zollicoffer's on the front lines. He's leading an army in the field. This guy is a blogger. I need to get someone with actual military experience over there. So Davis sent a guy to actually do the military stuff for this newspaper man who found himself to be a general. He sent a Kentuckian, Confederate doofus number 3, George B. Crittenden. George Bibb Crittenden was the son of Kentucky senator and statesman John Crittenden, who tried to do the compromise right before Fort Sumter. A West Point graduate and long-serving U.S. Army officer, Crittenden had fought for Texas and the United States in wars against Mexico, and he was recognized as a very brave soldier. So he seemed like a good choice to take command in eastern Kentucky. Well, except for one thing. Georgie boy liked to drink. He liked to drink a lot. America in the 19th century was a horrifyingly alcoholic time and place. You say, James, America drinks a lot these days, don't they? No, 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 you don't understand. You don't understand. The average American today drinks 2.5 gallons of alcohol in a year. And I can hear my wife shrieking from the other room at how horrifyingly unhealthy that is. Okay, 2.5 gallons a year. In the mid-19th century, the average was 7 gallons. 7 gallons of ethyl alcohol per year per person, on average. These people are insanely drunk. So to be well known for your alcohol problems in this period is kind of an achievement. This is Olympic level drinking. In 1848, George B. Crittenden was court-martialed and discharged from the army on charges of drunkenness. If you know anything about the 19th century American army, how drunk you have to be kicked out, you have to be extremely drunk. And that's where his story would end if not for, guess who? His friend, Jefferson Davis, who was a Mississippi politician, who pulled some strings and got Georgie boy reinstated. Jeff Davis had been old Senator Crittenden's friend for over a decade. So when Georgie got in trouble, Uncle Jeff came to the rescue and swept his alcohol abuse under the rug. George Crittenden hiccuped his way through active U.S. Army service until 1861, when the Civil War broke out. When Kentucky's neutrality ended, most of his family stayed loyal to the Union. Senator John Crittenden, his dad, stayed loyal to the Union. But to his father's fury, George decided to go south. George Crittenden accepted a general's commission in the Confederate Army, which Jefferson Davis made sure he got, despite everybody being like, hey, we know George Crittenden, he's a famous alcoholic, I knew him in the army. Jeff Davis is like, no, he's fine. George's brother Thomas Crittenden became a Union general. So the two sons of Kentucky's great compromiser, fighting on opposite sides, a literal case of brother against brother. So in late 1861, when Jeff Davis decided that a Tennessee newspaper man maybe shouldn't be leading the invasion of Kentucky, he thought of George Crittenden, with his West Point education and combat and military experience. Yeah, there were those, rumors of alcohol abuse, but Crittenden just seemed like a nice guy. So Davis placed Crittenden in command in East Tennessee, making him Zollicoffer's new boss. Crittenden was supposed to take charge of military operations with his military experience, and send Zollicoffer back to East Tennessee to do the political stuff with his, you know, political influence. But when Crittenden arrived in Knoxville in November 1861, he parked himself behind a desk, started drinking like a fish, and pissing off the locals with his heavy-handed political approach. Reading between the lines, Crittenden really wanted to stay in Knoxville. He didn't want to go to the field because, you know, there's no liquor in the field. So while Crittenden's eyeballs were floating in his skull, Zollicoffer continued to lead his small army deeper into Kentucky. And remember, handling the military side of things was supposed to be Crittenden's job. By November 1861, Zollicoffer's troops had reached the Cumberland River near the town of Somerset, Kentucky. On the south side of the river was a place called Mill Springs, where high bluffs overlooked the river. That would have been a great defensive position. Zollicoffer, whose knowledge of tactics was below that of a Fortnite player, decided that a better position was on the low northern bank, a big mud plain, instead of the high bluffs of the southern bank. Yeah, that looks like a much better place to set up. Then, he also decided to put his army in a little cul-de-sac, surrounded on three sides by the Cumberland River. So he's in like a bend of the river with only one exit. Zollicoffer was like, oh, this will force my enemy to come at me from only one direction. How clever. Anyone with 5 seconds of military training would see this as a death trap. You know who had military training? George Crittenden, who was drunk behind a desk in Knoxville. It is a military truism in every age, from the ancient world to the 21st century. You never, ever want to fight with your back to a river. It limits your ability to maneuver, it pins you down against the enemy, and if you have to retreat, oh boy, you are gonna have a bad time. Like, we just saw this in the Glory of the Khalsa episode at the Battle of Sobraon, where the Sikhs were defeated by the British with their back to a river, and they got slaughtered. Like, do not ever do this. Don't do this if you can help it. Zollicoffer told, you know, his boss's boss, General Albert Sidney Johnston, the Confederate commander in the West, of his amazing plan. Johnston was like, what? No, dude, no, do not put your back to a river. Absolutely do not do that. But it was too late. Zollicoffer had gotten a bunch of boats and rowed his 5,000 men to the other side of the Cumberland River. Johnston and Crittenden both ordered Zollicoffer, dude, get your butt back across the river. You are on the Union side of the river. You are a sitting duck. Don't be there. Well, unfortunately, by the time their messages reached him, it had started raining. It was raining a lot. Winter 1861 to 62 was a very wet winter in Kentucky, and the Cumberland River flooded. So Zollicoffer was like, guys, I'm kind of stuck over here. So just to recap, Crittenden, the guy appointed for his military ability, is handling the political situation and screwing it up. Zollicoffer, the guy appointed for his political ability, is handling the military situation and screwing it up. And now everyone in East Tennessee is mad, and now the main Confederate army in East Kentucky is trapped on the wrong side of the river. Let's hear it for Jefferson Davis's hiring decisions. And Zollicoffer was in trouble, because the Union was coming. And they were led by one of my favorite generals of all time, George Henry Thomas. George Thomas was a West Point graduate of 1840, where he became roommates and lifelong friends with his future boss, William Tecumseh Sherman. He performed brilliantly as an artillery officer in the Mexican-American War, he taught cavalry and artillery tactics at West Point, and he fought the Comanche on the Western Plains with the 2nd U.S. Cavalry. George Thomas had had a stellar military career before the Civil War. What made him unusual was that George Thomas was a Southerner who sided with the North. Thomas came from a slaveholding plantation family near Suffolk, Virginia. His family owned 15 slaves and 685 acres. And as a teenager, he was forced to flee his home during the Nat Turner slave uprising of 1831. But despite this background, it sounds like George Thomas had pretty negative feelings about slavery, and a stronger sense of loyalty to his nation than to his state. Plus, he'd married a northern woman, and, you know, getting married will often change your opinions about things. So when the Civil War broke out in 1861, George Thomas stayed loyal to the United States. Almost every other Virginian of his generation went south. Robert E. Lee, his superior in the 2nd Cavalry, went south. Braxton Bragg, his old friend from Mexico, went south. Jeb Stuart, who he had taught cavalry tactics at West Point, went south and vowed to kill Thomas if he ever saw him again. Jeb Stuart said,
"Old George H. Thomas is in command of the cavalry of the enemy. I would like to hang him as a traitor to his native state."
Thomas's decision to stay loyal to the Union instead of Virginia and the South alienated him from his family for the rest of his life. They burned his letters, turned his picture to the wall, and never spoke to him again. George Thomas's loyalty cost him friends, his family, his entire life. But it was a huge boost to the cause of the United States. George Thomas turned out to be one of the best generals of the war. The Confederacy could have used one or two George Thomases in the Western theater, instead of the Polks and the Zollicoffers. Thomas was put in charge of Union troops in eastern Kentucky. Soon units from Ohio and Indiana and Minnesota gathered, as Thomas supervised their training. There were even two regiments of East Tennessee men who had made their way north. Thomas's mounted force was the 1st Kentucky Cavalry. It was an army full of Southerners, lots of Kentuckians and Tennesseans in this army, and led by a Southerner who had stayed loyal to the Union. As a general, George Thomas was often criticized for being slow. Thomas wasn't slow so much as he was patient. This made him very good at drilling his men. He was well known as an excellent trainer and organizer. He was careful, methodical, always getting his ducks in a row before he hit. But when he did hit, he hit like a truck. So Thomas waited until January 1862, when he was good and ready, before marching south. His goal was to bring Zollicoffer to battle and drive him from Kentucky. Zollicoffer's army consisted of his own 1st Brigade and the 2nd Brigade of General William H. Carroll. These were almost all Tennessee regiments, except for the 15th Mississippi and 16th Alabama Infantry. Like, there's like 10 regiments in this army, 8 of them are Tennessee units, there's 1 Mississippi, 1 Alabama. And they were in pitiful condition. Their biggest problem was weaponry. This early in the war, the Confederacy was desperately short of infantry weapons. They just did not have enough small arms to go around. Lots of men, especially in Carroll's 2nd Brigade, didn't even have guns yet. In December 1861, the 39th Tennessee had 771 men, but only about 200 weapons. Like, what are they going to do if they have to fight a battle? Is this going to be some, like, enemy at the gate stuff? The first man takes the rifle, the second takes the ammunition. It's going to be real great for morale. George Crittenden later said,
"The men had only flintlock muskets, some squirrel rifles with saber bayonets and some without, and some shotguns, almost all out of fix and wholly unfit for service."
Zollicoffer and Crittenden had been begging for more guns for months, but the Confederacy just didn't have them. In contrast, almost all the Union regiments were armed with modern Minié rifles, mostly the British pattern Enfield. Zollicoffer's army was also poorly maintained. His camp was basically in a floodplain, it had been raining a lot, and the men were soaked to the bone, and they had very few supplies. This is why having, like, I don't know, one or two dudes who know what they're doing is really important. Civil War armies had this problem. There were not a lot of professional soldiers to go around, there were only so many officers in the former army, and they split between the North and the South. So most of the regiments on both sides were led by volunteer officers, just dudes off the street, who didn't know what they were doing. The Union and Confederate armies that are about to fight the Battle of Mill Springs had only two professional soldiers between them, George Thomas and George Crittenden. A Virginian from a Confederate state fighting for the North, and a Kentuckian from a Union state fighting for the South. As Thomas closed in on Zollicoffer's position in January 1862, George Crittenden suddenly decided, hey, I should probably be over there, shouldn't I? He got out from behind his desk and rode north to assume command in mid-January 1862. Like, he only shows up to his army after 2 months of being in charge. Crittenden got to Mill Springs, looked at the terrain, looked at the condition of the soldiers, and said, Oh, Zollicoffer, what have you done? But this was his fault, too. How do you not even visit your own army after 2 months in command? On January 17th, 1862, Thomas's army arrived at Logan's Crossroads. 10 miles to the north of Zollicoffer's position at Mill Springs. They were obviously getting ready to attack him. But the Confederates were still stuck on the wrong side of the very flooded Cumberland River. Trying to recross the river with the enemy this close would be dangerous. If Thomas attacked while they were in the middle of crossing, they were absolutely screwed. Abraham Lincoln, as only he could, had an analogy for what happens when an army is caught in the middle of a wet gap crossing.
Entangled upon the river, like an ox jumped half over a fence, and liable to be torn by dogs front and rear, without a fair chance to gore one way or kick the other.
So Zollicoffer had put the Confederate army in a position where they couldn't retreat, and if they stayed where they were with their backs to the river, they would be sitting ducks. And the army was almost out of supplies, again due to Crittenden's and Zollicoffer's joint mismanagement. Desperate times called for desperate measures. George Crittenden decided to attack Thomas before Thomas could attack him. This wasn't a good option, but Crittenden didn't have good options. He just had bad options, and this one was the least bad. With Zollicoffer's and Carroll's two brigades, Crittenden had about 5,500 to 6,000 men, while Thomas only had about 4,500 men on hand at Logan's Crossroads. But Thomas had reinforcements on the way, so Crittenden wanted to hit the Union forces while he still outnumbered them. He planned to make a night march north and attack Thomas at Logan's Crossroads before Union reinforcements arrived. Now, this battle is semi-infamous to Civil War historians because it's been called, like, 5 different names. The battle took place in a kind of a weird spot between a bunch of different landmarks and creeks and towns. So one regiment might see a mill over there. Oh, we're going to name the battle after that mill. One regiment's next to a creek. Oh, we're going to name the battle after this creek. No one can agree. The Union called it Logan's Crossroads or Somerset. The Confederates called it Fishing Creek or Beech Grove. But the modern consensus, in the name of the U.S. National Historic Landmark, is Mill Springs. The Confederates started marching at midnight. It was a cold, wet winter night. Soon it began to rain, and the column descended into a miserable mass of drenched soldiers slogging along dirt trails through the night. One private in the 19th Tennessee remembered.
The night was dark and cold, and the bitter winds drove sleet and rain in our faces. Yet on we went, plodding through the gloom and mud.
The column fell afoul of the slinky effect. Zollicoffer's 1st Brigade, with its 3,000 men, 4-gun artillery battery, and cavalry detachment, turned the road into mush behind them, slowing down Carroll's 2nd Brigade. The going was much slower than Crittenden had predicted. Most of his men were still marching when the sun rose, on January 19, 1862. The first shots of the Battle of Mill Springs rang out at 5:30 a.m. when Zollicoffer's men made contact with the outposts of the Union's 1st Kentucky Cavalry, and they immediately lost any element of surprise they might have had. A brisk, crackling fire broke up the rainy gloom of an early dawn in eastern Kentucky. The Mill Springs battlefield extended along a muddy road, with a few open areas amidst the heavy, deep, dark forests. Fog and mist was everywhere, and the cold rain continued to fall throughout the day. The Confederates suffered because most of their older weapons, especially the flintlocks, were almost useless in the rain compared to the Union's modern rifles. The weather also hurt the Confederates in another way. Multiple accounts of Mill Springs note how hard it was for anyone to see anything in the fog and gun smoke and overcast gloom. And for Felix K. Zollicoffer, who was borderline blind on a good day, it was even worse. Zollicoffer, wearing a bright white raincoat, squinted through the dark morning into the dark trees. He saw muzzle flashes with no idea who was shooting. He saw distant mobs of men with no idea who they were and no idea whose side they were on. He couldn't even tell where they were going. He couldn't tell how big the enemy force was, what they were doing, what position they were in. Being nearsighted was a big problem on a Civil War battlefield. It even gets even worse. This is a time period in the Civil War before big uniform standardization set in. Lots of Union units at Mill Springs wore gray uniforms, and a lot of Zollicoffer's men were wearing blue uniforms. It's not going well. George Crittenden had been worried about the possibility of friendly fire for this very reason. The night beforehand, he had ordered the Confederates to use the running password Kentucky to identify each other and prevent friendly fire. Having a password is a good idea, polite applause, but why Kentucky when some of the Union units are from Kentucky and you're in Kentucky and they might be yelling things like hurrah for Kentucky? Why is this your password? Well, during the planning conference for the battle, rumor had it that General Crittenden was drunk. And that tracks with what we know about him. And so was General Carroll, the other brigade commander. And it sounds like they were still drunk on the morning of the battle. So Zollicoffer is the only sober Confederate general at Mill Springs, and he can't freaking see. And he's wearing a big white raincoat for some reason that makes it very easy to see him. Zollicoffer's regiments formed into a loose battle line, very disorganized, no coordination. Zollicoffer's job as a brigade commander was to sort this out, to get his troops into position and tell them what to do. But Zollicoffer lasered in on one regiment, the 19th Tennessee, and just sort of stuck with them throughout the battle, probably because that was the extent of what he could see was one regiment. The rest of his units just sort of drifted into battle on their own initiative. Colonel Malin D. Manson was the Union commander on the spot when Zollicoffer began his attack. He rode back to Thomas's headquarters at Logan's Crossroads to tell him the battle had started. Manson was not, again, an experienced commander. He had been an Indiana politician before the war and didn't realize that he should have sent a messenger, like, "Your brigade commander, your place is managing and fighting your brigade, you don't need to come back and deliver information to your commander." So George Thomas chewed him out. He said,
"Damn you, sir, go back to your command and fight it."
Colonel Manson ran back to the battle line, his tail between his legs, but on the way he started rousing up his units and sending them towards the battle. The 10th Indiana Infantry was the first Union infantry regiment to really get into the fight. Private Wesley L. Moore remembered that morning.
"The first we knew of the fight, we were preparing to eat breakfast when our messenger came in from the line of action, and the camp was soon alarmed by the long roll, and we were shortly arrayed in line of battle with our guns and cartridge boxes on. We were hurried off to battle."
Thanks to Zollicoffer's poor handling of his men, the Confederate attack only got underway about an hour after the first shots had been fired. This delay gave the 10th Indiana time to arrive and reinforce the 1st Kentucky Cavalry. Corporal Eastham Tarrant of the 1st Kentucky described the conditions on the battlefield.
"Owing to the foggy morning and the thinness of the atmosphere, the smoke of the conflict hovered down over the contestants like a pall, as if to shroud the bloody carnage."
The 19th and 20th Tennessee began the attack with frontal assaults that failed to drive off the Indiana and Kentucky troops. Private Derek Harrison of the 10th Indiana.
"We commenced the work and we kept up a constant fire on them. We gave them some of the infield slugs, which made them weak in the knees. We stood and fought them until we was out of ammunition."
The Indiana Infantry and Kentucky Cavalry held off much larger numbers of Confederates for over an hour. Several things worked in their favor. The muddy roads slowed the Confederates down. The weather obscured their line of sight. The Union troops had cover and concealment in the woods, and Zollicoffer failed to get all his regiments into the fight. He was still like micro-focused in the 19th Tennessee. He wasn't leading his brigade. Finally, the 10th Indiana's Minier rifles were superior to most of the Confederate weapons. Out of all the Southern units, only the 15th Mississippi carried modern rifles. The Confederates discovered that many of their old flintlocks, which had to be primed with black powder, were virtually useless in the wet conditions. One soldier estimated that as many as 1 in 3 of his regiment's weapons misfired. The Union troops were forced to fall back when the 15th Mississippi outflanked them through a ravine. Of all the Union casualties at Mill Springs, half of them came from the 10th Indiana. But as the Hoosiers and Kentuckians retreated, they received reinforcements. The 4th Kentucky Infantry under Colonel Speed S. Fry. Colonel Fry had served in the Mexican-American War, and he had been a judge just before the Civil War. He had raised and organized the local pro-Union militias that became the 4th Kentucky, one of the first Union regiments raised from the state. The 4th Kentucky joined the battle. The gunfire picked up, now joined by booms, as northern and southern artillery began to fire cannonballs and shells. The Confederate attacks were ferocious, but uncoordinated and unorganized. Zollicoffer wasn't doing his job. He wasn't running his brigade. He couldn't see that far, and even if he had, he didn't really know how to run his brigade anyway. The darkness and smoke and fog were almost impenetrable. The rough terrain disrupted the formations, and units started to get lost and turned around. Soon the 19th and 20th Tennessee and the 15th Mississippi began to take heavy losses. A Tennessean remembered.
"This was our first regular battle, and our company and regiment suffered dreadfully. It was reported afterwards that we had lost 40% of our number engaged."
At one point, Zollicoffer looked around and realized he had lost track of his units. He was with the 19th Tennessee. He looked around like, hey, where's the rest of my brigade? So he rode off with a staff officer to try and find his men. Peering into the foggy, smoky gloom, Zollicoffer saw a blue-uniformed regiment where he thought the 15th Mississippi was supposed to be. But problem was, they were facing the wrong way, shooting in the wrong direction. Ugh, what are these guys doing? Zollicoffer, his white raincoat flapping, spurred his horse and rode over to the unit to try and correct their mistake. Colonel Speed S. Fry of the Union's 4th Kentucky Infantry was on the road looking out for reinforcements when he saw someone coming up to talk to him.
"I saw an officer riding slowly down the road on a white horse and within 20 paces of my regiment. His uniform was concealed by a long overcoat. Everything I saw led me to believe he was a federal officer belonging to some of the regiments just arriving."
The two men pulled up alongside each other on horseback, so close that their knees were touching. The other officer, of course, was Confederate General Felix K. Zollicoffer. Neither Fry nor Zollicoffer realized that the other guy was an enemy officer. Fry had an excuse. Zollicoffer was wearing a big white raincoat that concealed his uniform, and he was wearing a blue cap and blue trousers that looked like a Union uniform. But Colonel Fry's uniform was very plainly a Union uniform. Zollicoffer is like, huh, that looks weird. Can't really see, oh well. Zollicoffer told Fry that he had to be careful not to shoot his own men. Fry was like, yeah, dude, we're facing the right way. Like, what's the issue? Like, he didn't even know who this guy was. Zollicoffer pointed at the 19th Tennessee off in the distance like, those are our men. You're facing them. Fix yourself. Fry's like, hey, those don't look like our guys. Are you sure those aren't, like, you know, rebels? He must not have heard, Zollicoffer must not have heard that. And he's like, hey, go take a look. So Fry rode over to try to get a better look at this unit. Like, what's going on here? When Zollicoffer's staff officer suddenly appeared behind a tree screaming, look out, General, and fired a revolver at Colonel Fry. Several eyewitness accounts dispute the details of what happened next. This is my best guess. Colonel Fry realized that the mysterious officer that he'd just been talking to was a Confederate. He yelled at his troops to fire and pulled out his own revolver. Fry remembered.
He was standing precisely in the position which I had left him, with his face towards me.
Fry pulled out his revolver and aimed it at Zollicoffer, and it sounds like Zollicoffer was so shocked he didn't even move, or maybe he just didn't see it coming. He was like, huh, that looks weird. Is that a gun? Fry fired, and so did several men of the 4th Kentucky. Fry claimed he fired the fatal shot, but Zollicoffer was hit by at least two rifle bullets as well, so this is really just about bragging rights at this point. Either way, General Zollicoffer was dead before he hit the ground. Zollicoffer's death threw the Confederate attack into even further confusion. It took a long, long time for George Crittenden to hear about this, arrive on the battlefield, and take control. Well, kind of. Crittenden ordered up General Carroll's brigade and tried to make a general push with all the Confederate units. But he and Carroll were both very, very slow to get moving, and, like, the way they handled the battle does not make it seem like they were really in control of anything, lending further evidence to the narrative that they were both drunk. The Confederate regiments were fed into the battle haphazardly, one at a time, attacking fiercely but separately, making very little headway. Like, they're not all attacking at once, they're sort of like sort of attacking one at a time, like that scene in The Matrix Reloaded where everybody's fighting Neo one at a time, when if they all just attacked him at once, they could beat him. The 25th Tennessee, advancing near where Zollicoffer fell, mistook the Union troops for their own men and ceased fire. They probably heard somebody yelling, "Kentucky, Kentucky," and thought, "Oh, that's the password. I guess we shouldn't shoot those guys," before the Union 4th Kentucky Regiment poured volleys into them and drove them from the field. That password was a bad idea. At this point in the battle, George Thomas arrived with reinforcements and sized up the situation. Like, the Union general's here now, and he's looking around like, okay, let's figure this out. He sent the 2nd Minnesota into the battle line to help the 4th Kentucky hold off the Confederate attacks, and he sent his other units to flank the Confederates in a double envelopment. The 9th Ohio looped around the Confederate left, while the 1st and 2nd East Tennessee hit them from the right. Yes, Union Tennessee troops versus Confederate Tennessee troops. And unlike Crittenden and Zollicoffer, who would just dribble their units into the battle, Thomas was coordinating a decisive blow. The 2nd Minnesota arrived just in time to hold off the last charge of the 15th Mississippi, fighting at a rail fence. One Minnesotan said,
"The trees were flecked with bullets and the underbrush was cut away as with a scythe. The dead and wounded lay along the fence. Further on, the enemy's dead were everywhere scattered across the open field."
The battle lines between the Minnesotans and Mississippians were so close that each side's muskets were poking through the same fence. Just as the Confederate attack was stalling out, George Thomas unleashed his attack. As his artillery boomed, both of his flank attacks crunched into the Confederate army. Leading the way was the 9th Ohio, a unit of mostly German immigrants from Cincinnati. Colonel Robert L. McCook of the 9th Ohio was one of Ohio's Fighting McCooks, 17 men of a Scotch-Irish clan who all fought for the Union in the Civil War. 3 of them were killed. Robert McCook was wounded leading the 9th Regiment into battle, being hit in the knee. I used to be a Union officer, but then I took a bullet to the knee. Okay, I get it. 2011 wants its memes back. Moving on. The 9th Ohio's attack finally shattered Confederate resistance. Both their flanks broke, and the Southern regiments collapsed like a stack of dominoes. Nothing Crittenden or Carroll did could stop their men from fleeing. They were probably too drunk to really manage themselves at this point. Almost out of ammunition after the morning's fight, the 10th Indiana used their bayonets on any stragglers they found hiding along in the trees. Corporal Solomon Strafford of the 10th Indiana remembered running through the forest when he saw a Confederate soldier hiding behind a tree. Stafford remembered,
"I stuck my bayonet in him. He cried, 'For God's sake, don't kill me.' I said, 'God damn you, it is too late to talk now.' He would have killed me if I had not killed him."
The Battle of Mill Springs was over. Thomas's army pursued, herding the Confederates towards the Cumberland River. The Southern army gathered any boats they could find and recrossed the river. They were forced to abandon their supplies and equipment, including 12 cannons, 150 wagons, and more than 1,000 horses and pack animals. They also left most of their wounded and all of their dead. The Union artillery fired at the Confederates all night, blowing several boats out of the water and throwing men into the raging river. When the bedraggled, starving remnants of Crittenden's army finally reached Tennessee, they were combat ineffective. This is why you don't put your back to a river. Casualties were very light by Civil War standards. The Union only lost 39 killed and 207 wounded. Confederate casualties were much higher, 125 killed and 404 wounded or captured. It was a small battle with a big impact. Thomas's victory had run the Confederates out of eastern Kentucky and broken their main defensive line in the Western Theater. Combined with Ulysses S. Grant's victory at Fort Donelson a month later, this paved the way for the Union to invade Tennessee, beginning the invasion of the Confederate heartland. More than that, Mill Springs was the Union's first major battlefield victory of the American Civil War. It was a much-needed morale boost, like the Union hadn't won a big battle yet. It ensured that Kentucky stayed in the fight against the Confederacy when a defeat might have caused the state to consider seceding. And Mill Springs set the tone for the war in the Western Theater as a whole. Robert E. Lee, defeated one incompetent Union general after another in the Eastern Theater, but here the shoe was on the other foot. Competent Union generals like Thomas and Grant and Sherman would routinely defeat incompetent Confederate leaders like Zollicoffer or Crittenden or Pemberton or Bragg or Hood. The Union acclaimed George H. Thomas for his victory. Before the battle, some people had doubted the loyalty of this scion of a slaveholding Virginia family. No longer. Thomas had won the Union's first great victory of the Civil War, and this was only the beginning. He would become one of the North's most able and dependable generals. He ascended into legend as the Rock of Chickamauga for his glorious defensive stand at that battle that saved a Union army from destruction. And in the last great battle of the Western Theater, the Battle of Nashville in December 1864, he would demolish the Confederate army of John Bell Hood in one of the most brilliant tactical performances of the Civil War. Even though he's not as famous as Grant or Sherman, Thomas deserves recognition as one of the four or five best Union generals, and a pretty good counterexample when someone brings up Robert E. Lee's decision to join the South. People will say, Lee couldn't fight against Virginia, he couldn't fight against his home. Well, he had the same choice George Thomas did. Which one do you think was the more morally courageous act? Let me know in the comments. As Thomas's star rose, George Crittenden's fell. He was scapegoated for the defeat at Mill Springs, and it was widely known that he had been intoxicated. Given his family's known Unionist loyalties, he was even accused of treason. Jefferson Davis defended Crittenden and made sure he got a new position as a corps commander. But then 2 months later, in March 1862, Crittenden's superior had him arrested for being drunk on duty. Like, dude, you've gotten so many chances, second chances you shouldn't have gotten. Davis tried to cover up this too, but no one was having it. George Crittenden resigned his commission in disgrace and played no further role in the American Civil War. Jefferson Davis sure knew how to pick him. Felix K. Zollicoffer's body lay in the mud throughout the Battle of Mill Springs, and soldiers kept stopping by to grab buttons or threads or other souvenirs from it before George Thomas posted a guard over the corpse. Colonel Speed S. Fry took Zollicoffer's sword and made the story of how he allegedly killed the Confederate general into the cornerstone of his post-war political career. Just like splash that up on a recruitment, on a election poster in 1875. I shot a guy! Thomas ensured that Zollicoffer's body was taken care of and embalmed after the battle, and eventually buried in Nashville, Tennessee. Zollicoffer became a Tennessee martyr, its most prominent citizen to die in the early Civil War, though he would soon be superseded. There were a lot more martyrs coming down the pipeline. Still, this man had no business being a general in the Civil War, from his physical issues alone. I have never heard of anyone Mr. Magooing his way into a battle like this guy. Well, except for King John of Bohemia at the Battle of Crecy, but that's another story. The Mill Springs battlefield has been preserved by the American Battlefield Trust, and in 2019 it was officially established as a national monument. It's never gotten the attention of the big battles like Gettysburg or Spotsylvania or Shiloh. It was a small battle with a big impact. There's a visitor center and a museum, and there are reenactments a couple times a year. The Union dead are buried at Mill Springs National Cemetery, while the Confederates lie in Zollicoffer Park on the battlefield itself. The site where Zollicoffer was killed is marked by an obelisk and a white oak tree planted on the site. Small, humble icons for the place where the Union won its first decisive victory of the Civil War and the South lost Kentucky. Say what you will about Felix K. Zollicoffer. He literally never saw it coming. Before we go today, I have a couple of questions for you to ponder. What would have happened if the Union had been the ones to violate Kentucky neutrality and not the Confederacy? What if Robert E. Lee had been in charge of Kentucky and not the trio of doofuses I described today? What if the Battle of Mill Springs never happens and the war in the West goes much worse for the Union? And how would that affect the war in the East? If you're interested in alternate history fiction or Civil War fiction and you like today's episode, are you in luck? I'd like to do a little plug for my good friend, Liam Rook, who examines these questions and their consequences in his novel Patriots and Traitors, the first in a series. The second volume is expected to come out later this year, co-authored by another friend of mine, T.K. Blackwood. Patriots and Traitors is great. It's a Civil War story that didn't happen but could have, and it features the viewpoints of generals and soldiers, of white men and black men, of great commanders and common folk swept up into the maelstrom. It is a fine piece of writing. I'm happy to endorse it. So for an alternate version of the events I described today, check out Patriots and Traitors on Amazon, and keep an eye out for the sequel, Almighty Vengeance, coming later this year. That being said, thanks a bunch for listening today. Tell your friends about this podcast. Just maybe think a second or two before you make them a general, no matter how much you like them. Or tell your enemies about this podcast, if you can tell them from your friends, though you'll probably do better than Felix Zollicoffer. Check out my website at unknownsoldierspodcast.com for today's sources. If you have questions, comments, concerns, or hate mail, you can message me on Facebook or email me at unknownsoldierspodcast@gmail.com. Finally, I have to look to the near future. I will confess right now, I am exhausted and burnout. We just spent the last several weeks moving into the new house. Nothing is unpacked yet. Every weekend I have coming up is booked out the butt. I have family reunion. I have two drills and then two solid weeks of army training. I still have to work a 40-hour job when I'm not doing that. So what I'm trying to say is, guys, I just don't know when the final episode of season 2 is coming out. I still have to write it, and I want to get it right. It's gonna be work. It will be done. So I ask once again, as I've been having to ask for months now, one last time, for your patience. It will be done when it's done. I don't know when, but I will get it done. See you then for the last episode of Unknown Soldiers Podcast Season 2. Yours, as always, James Hauser.